All right. Well, anyway, Dave, are you there?
I am. Yes.
Okay. All right. Well, David Farland's now on the line, so we'll go ahead and start the call. So I want to welcome you, Dave, and thank you for joining us this evening. It's a big honor to have you here, and we're excited to hear what you have to tell us tonight.
That's good to be with everybody here.
And I want to welcome everybody to the first David Farland's Authors Advisory Conference call. And tonight, as I had said, we're talking with Dave Wolverton, also known as David Farland, New York Times bestselling author of science fiction fantasy, who served for many years as the coordinating judge for the Writers of the Future contest and as a creative writing instructor at Brigham Young University. As an instructor, he's trained many authors who've gone on to become New York Times bestsellers themselves. Some of these include Brandon Sanderson, Brandon Mull, Eric Flint, and Sean Williams, just to name a few. And first off, Dave, let me ask you, at what point in your life did you decide you wanted to become an author?
Well, I think that jump was made when I was about 17 years old. I had become a big fantasy fan. I'd been reading Tolkien, and I had read pretty much everything in my library that was fantasy, and I'd started looking for all of the books off the shelf. And I got to the point where I ran out of books and started making up my own stories. And I was telling them to a friend at work, and he said, you know, you should take all this stuff and put it in a book. And I realized, wait a minute, that's exactly what everybody else is doing. I should do that too. So at that point, I was just about 17 years old. I went down and bought myself a typewriter the next day and began practicing the craft of being a writer.
Wow. Awesome. Another question I had, how many books or short stories did you write before you were published?
Well, I started a couple of different novels, and in both cases, I'd gotten about 10 chapters into them and got stuck and couldn't figure out what to do next. And so I went out and bought a bunch of books on writing. And, I actually, when you talk about getting published, I think it was my third short story that got published in a student journal. And
oh, really?
Won a writing prize. And then my fourth one won another prize. My fifth one, sixth one, seventh, all won first places in various contests around the country, which led to one of them ended up winning the Writers of the Future contest. So I started publishing very, very quickly.
Wow.
However, I thought about it a lot before I began writing. So it wasn't a matter of not practicing my craft. I was constantly critiquing stories and critiquing movies and trying to figure out how things worked.
Hmm. And you still do both of those things very well. I've been in some of your courses. Another question along the lines of getting published. When you got around to writing your first book, which I think was On My Way to Paradise, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
When you got around to writing that one, and what was the hardest part about getting that accepted by a publisher or an agent?
Well, I had won the Writers of the Future contest with a short story called On My Way to Paradise, and basically I had a couple of people pulling for me. Robert Silverberg was one of the contest judges at the time, and he took it to another publisher in Hollywood and said, you know, we really ought to offer this guy a hardcover, softcover deal. Silverberg at the time was working for Donald I. Fine, which was a small hardback publisher in New York. And so they had spoken about it a little bit. And when I went to the Writers of the Future, based upon that short story, when I went to the award ceremony in New York, they were sort of ready there to hand me a contract. Unfortunately, just a couple of weeks before that, the other editor died, passed away from a heart attack, a sudden massive heart attack, and Robert Silverberg had quit his job. But Robert had talked to other people in New York, and based upon that, I had about 8 different publishers who came up and visited me after the award ceremony and gave me their cards and said, we'd love to see a novel proposal. And so within about 3 days, I had a 3-book contract with Bantam Books. It just went really, really fast.
Wow. I've heard you say that after you decided what genre you're going to break into as a writer, that you need to do audience analysis to make sure you can reach the widest audience you possibly can. So that you can sell more, as many books as you possibly can. Since all of us are writers out there, and some of us are probably wondering, what exactly is audience analysis?
Okay. Well, you know, what you do is you have to look at who your audience is. You know, the biggest problem that I see, a lot of people who come in, you know, they master some of the fundamentals pretty quickly. And most of the writing courses that you can take across the country in college and in high school even will teach you how to narrate a story and, you know, how to write description and how to handle your dialogue a little bit. But most new authors err in sort of writing to a very small audience, you know. They write stories that are really usually written for them, you know, or for a family member or something. And there's a couple of different approaches that you can take to analyzing your audience. You look at, you know, how old are they? Are they male or female? You know, what is their education level? Where do they come from? You know, what are their political opinions and things like that? And then you start saying, okay, what do these people like? You know, what do they really enjoy? And, you know, if you if working in Hollywood, I worked as a greenlighting analyst and a bit. And, you know, we talked about things like, you know, if you look at children, you know, from the ages of say 9 through 12, you know, they like humor, horror, adventure, comedy, pretty much in that order, you know, or excuse me, not comedy, humor, horror, adventure, mystery, and pretty much in that order. And so if you look at them, you look at something like Goosebumps, you start realizing that the author didn't attract a wide audience by accident. You know, he had exactly the right formula to attract children that age. The same is true if you start looking for older audiences. If you look at a female audience beginning at the age of, say, about 13 to 14, young girls start becoming interested in romance. You know, as they mature and their hormones get going. So romance becomes the biggest draw by the time that a girl is 16. And so when they're looking at a movie commercial, if it promises romance, then they become interested in it. And so we start moving some of those other things down, you know. We start looking at things like the humor and the horror. Those aren't quite as important as the romance anymore. So you get a nice mix where you say, okay, if I'm going to be writing to that audience, I need to have this emotional element in it. And I should mention that even though in audience analysis in Hollywood, we don't talk about wonder as a huge emotional draw. That's one of the huge ones for kids, you know, up until the late teens, early 20s at the very least. So science fiction and fantasy stories and horror movies, all of those are really, really attractive to a younger audience.
Yeah, which is probably by Lord of the Rings movies and
exactly. So you get
Potter
that
well.
Exactly. Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter. And so you can go a couple of different ways. One way to get a large audience is to write for a broad audience where you say, I'm going to write a novel that both boys and girls will like and that the old people and young people will all like. And so you get something like Harry Potter, where if you look at it really closely, you know, Harry Potter is sort of the main character, but we also have Hermione as somebody that we like. And if you look at the teachers, there are male teachers and female teachers. You know, you've got Hagrid and you've got the old master of the college and, you know, this kind of thing. And so J.K. Rowling is really probably one of the most brilliant writers there is when it comes to audience analysis. She just knew what it was that was going to attract her audience. And so she wrote for a very broad audience. But you can also write to a deep audience. And by that I mean you look at a certain audience and say, I'm not going to just try to get some of those readers. I'm going to try to get all of those readers. And so when you look at Stephanie Meyer in Twilight, she goes for the young adult female audience, and she got a huge segment of that audience by writing a very strong, romantic, wondrous novel. That's the way that you do it. So writing to your audience and trying to get very deep penetration of the audience is the other way that you try to handle your audience analysis.
Okay, and when you're doing your audience analysis, is there a certain procedure that you'd follow?
There's not a real procedure for it. I mean, There's a scientific way that's done that's in Hollywood that the average person just can't do, and that is you make a commercial, you look at it and say, okay, we're going to take exit polls from people who come to see this movie and find out, you know, where did they hear about it and this kind of thing, and what attracted them to it. And you can look at the formulas. There's certain formulas that you can start making up and say, okay, we have in this commercial we showed 40 romantic beats and 10 wonder beats, and we maybe had 2 horror beats and 3 adventure beats. And you can look at that formula and see how many beats you had, and then see how many people actually come to the movie based upon how widely it was advertised. And by doing all of that, you can come up with a really specific formula that shows you within 2% how many people will come see that movie. Now, after having said that, that's much harder to do with a book. You just don't have that kind of money, that kind of marketing power. And so what you do is you start studying other books. You start looking at what succeeds. You know, go look at their covers. Go look at the way that if you've got a new author who takes off, you know, look at who their audience is. How are they doing it? And after a while of studying in this fashion, you can get pretty good at calling books and say, okay, this one's going to go big, that one's not, this one, you know, that kind of thing. Unfortunately, even if you get really good at it, if you go to New York and take it to an editor there, they don't have that kind of training. And so many editors in New York are pretty clueless, you know. I mean, they come up through the secretarial pool, and they might be avid readers and stuff, and they might know what they like, but they might not be very good at judging what others will like.
Okay. Let's see. Another question I had along the lines of writing, and you've talked about Tolkien and about J.K. Rowling and how they targeted their audience. What exactly is resonance? Like, if you want something to appeal to, I don't know, appeal to a certain demographic, I guess.
Yeah. Well, resonance is, how should I say, it's emotional triggers that are hidden inside of stories. When we study music, the term resonance is used to mean something that gains power based upon what came before. And what that really means is that music, very often, if you've got a little tune, it will repeat itself. And as the thing repeats itself, it becomes stronger. You know, you take Beethoven's Fifth, you know, bum, 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 bum. And then all of a sudden he starts doing a variation on it. Bum, 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 bum. You know, it goes like that, okay? Well,
yeah.
The same thing happens in books. If you read a book or a story and it's really powerful, then you will like it. You'll sort of, for unknown reasons, you'll go, wow, this is really good. I don't know why. It reminds me of Lord of the Rings, which I really loved, you know. And so people start reading entire genres based upon resonance, you know. So you get a book that comes along like,
Lord of Shannara.
You could do something like that, okay? You got Lord of the Rings, and then you go look at the sort of Shannara, and that's very, very much like Lord of the Rings. And then a few years later, Robert Jordan came along, and you started reading Robert Jordan, and he was very, very much like Lord of the Rings, too. And so those were a couple of authors that gained power off of resonance. The same thing happens in every single genre, though. You know, people start reading in genres because they find something they like, and then they stick with it. That's really what it comes down to. They say, oh, this fits my taste. And so, you know, for example, by putting a dragon on a cover of a fantasy novel, you sell a whole lot more fantasy novels because people have read stories about dragons and they want to read more stories about dragons. And I've had people who come in and look at the fifth book in the Rune Lord series and they go, oh, cool, a dragon. I want to read that novel, you know. And all they know about it is it's got a dragon on the cover. So, you know, resonance is a really powerful thing, but that's one kind of resonance, literary resonance. But there's other ways to resonate with a reader. For example, all of us have gone to school, and so we've had to deal with bullies. We've had to deal with inscrutable teachers. We've had to deal with teachers who maybe didn't want to do us well, that were actually actively trying to destroy our careers before we hardly got started. And so if you write a story where that something like that happens in a story, the way that J.K. Rowling did, she was using resonance from real life so that kids who read those books would go, oh, yeah, that's happened to me. I've been picked on and bullied before, too. I know exactly how that kid feels. And it rings true, you know, so the story resonates with us. So sometimes you can resonate with life, with other literature, you know, with all sorts of things.
And another question along those lines, how critical is that to resonate with something that people can hook onto? If you wanted to, I don't know, throw out the window the fact that Harry was an orphan or something, if you want to twist or something on Harry Potter, would it still work that way, or would you have shot yourself in the foot because...
Well, you know, if you write something that doesn't resonate, it won't ring true, okay? And so if it doesn't resonate with life at all, if you've got a kid who's, 9 years old, and all he thinks about is how he's going to make $1 million by the time that he's 30. You know, most kids don't think about that, and he might start coming off a little bit strange. If we then have him looking at his teacher and thinking, boy, I'd sure like to sleep with that one, you know, people are going to go, what? A 9 year old is thinking that way? No way. That doesn't happen, you know. And so what will happen is you'll lose your audience. So you have to resonate with things. You have to resonate with the world and present a truthful picture at the very least. Resonating with other literature is optional. You know, if you have a novel and you want to resonate with the audience for the Twilight series, then, you know, you could put in vampires. You could have it very lusty and romantic. And that novel could actually do quite well based upon what we call the halo effect, which is that when you've got a great big novel out there and it's doing really well in a certain genre and, you know, people want to read in that genre, if you go to Barnes & Noble right now, you'll probably find a table there with about 50 different vampire young adult novels on it just for those kids who want to read that stuff. I have a friend back in the 1990s who wrote a few of them, didn't do very well. Her career sort of died, and suddenly when Twilight came out, her books started getting reprinted, and she made, 20 times as much money on each novel as what she did when she first published it. So resonating with another really popular novel, you know, catching the wave is one way to take your books and make them bigger.
All right. And I guess to get down to a nuts and bolts level as far as the writing, if you're building an outline for a story, are there steps that you should take to make sure that you've got enough resonance so people have enough to I guess, hook onto as they're reading your story or your book so that it'll keep them interested?
Well, write honestly. You know, you write about the way that people really feel, the way they really speak, and the way they really think, and that's just that's just one way to catch resonance and to resonate with things. The other thing is to know your genre. You know, if you start writing in romance and you have never written in that genre before, the chances are that you can't write in that genre, period. The reason why is because there's certain code words that people in romance know about and which resonate with them that you have never really mastered. So, you know, the ones I like to cite as examples are, you know, if you meet the hero of a novel in a romance, you know, very often he has gray eyes, spelled G-R-E-Y. Why does it have gray eyes with G-R-E-Y? That's because Heathcliff had gray eyes, G-R-E-Y, you know, 150, 200 years ago. And people read those novels and fell in love with the early romance novels, and they read them in school, and that became sort of central to what romance novels resonate off. Similarly, you know, they'll talk about body parts like, you know, his manhood, you know, which in no other genre does anybody talk about that. You know, in science fiction, I don't say, you know, he got kicked in the manhood, you know. People would just laugh at that and go, that's ridiculous. Well, it isn't ridiculous because it's part of the secret code word and the secret code of reading in that genre. Similarly, when we get into medieval fantasy, very often we'll have sort of an antiquated medieval type of speech, and we'll use words that probably aren't being used very much in other areas. You know, if I talk about armor, you know, and I start getting into the nitty gritty of armor, you know, most people who are really into the whole fantasy genre, you know, if I mention that you know, his breastplate felt a bit loose or something like that. Most people who are reading in that genre know exactly what I'm talking about. Meanwhile, if I were to say, you know, he rested his hand on his breastplate and I was writing in a contemporary story, people go, what in the devil is a breastplate? You know, they've probably never heard of it. So, you know, there's certain things that, you know, become sort of common knowledge in any genre, and you just have to really understand that in order to write them.
Well, I guess a question that occurred to me while you were talking, what about if you mix genres, like say urban fantasy or something like that? Are there terms that are interchangeable, or?
Well, you know, that's a good question. Yeah, even when you mix genres, you have to just sort of decide, okay, is it a 50-50 split, or is it a 60-40, or is it a 80-20? I think that one of the problems with mixing genres is that you sort of enter a no man's land. You know, you have people who, you know, let's say I mix science fiction and fantasy. If I have a person who really loves science fiction, he may never read a fantasy, period. And a few years ago, and I don't know if this study is still current, but, you know, the mix was about 40% of the people preferred science fiction and 60% preferred fantasy. And of those, 20% of the science, you know, half of the science fiction people never read fantasy, period. You know, they just didn't feel like they wanted to read it. And about 50% of the people in fantasy didn't want to read it. So what happens is you sort of narrow your audience to those people who will read both science fiction and fantasy. And that's sort of the weakness that you get in when you start mixing genres. And it's hard to find a balance.
Let's see. And another question that I had, you're known for your rich world development. When you're world building, how much time do you spend on your world creation and your background information before you actually go and write the novel?
Well, it really depends upon the story. You know, if I'm doing a contemporary novel, you know, I was going to say I probably don't do much, but the fact is I probably do about the same amount. There's different ways to approach it. In a science fiction story, I would look at what the planet is like, maybe, that the story is going to be set in. I would decide how dense it is, how far it is from the sun, what its rotation is from the sun, how long its days are versus how long its night, how large is the, you know, given its mass, what's its specific gravity going to be? You know, is it full Earth gravity? Is it 1.5 Gs, you know, or is it going to be, you know, 0.38 Gs, you know, that type of thing. So you can get into that type of world creation and just really kind of go crazy in science fiction. In fantasy, you have a little bit more latitude. You may be describing things like magic systems or cultures and languages and things like that. And so you can spend a lot of time dealing with that. I did a historical novel a couple of years ago, and I spent a good year and a half doing research, you know, traveling along the trail where these people were actually going to be, had actually gone, reading journals from hundreds of different people, reading articles from newspapers and magazines and books that were written contemporary with their travels and stuff like that. So you can do a lot of world creation, but I think the important thing about world creation is that, you know, your character and your societies have to grow from the world that you create. And so it's all interconnected. It's not just a matter of creating a pretty setting. It's a matter of figuring out what kind of character your person is really going, you know, your major characters, what kind of people are they really going to be? You know, what are they going to think about things? What's their education level? What are they going to say? You know, how do they talk? What are attitudes about death and taxes and things like that in that society? And so I have to go back and really develop my worlds pretty well before I can create my characters. And then, you know, once I create my characters, I don't want to just create characters, you know. I don't want to have my story, in most cases, be just about anybody. I want to create fascinating characters, people who have interesting thoughts. You know, there are some people that never have much in the way of thought going on in their head. I used to have a good friend years ago, and I would go visit his dad, and that guy had nothing going on up there, you know. He never had anything to say about anything. I'd ask him what football game he was watching on TV, and he'd say, I don't know. He didn't know who the teams were. He didn't really care. He'd just be sitting there with a beer in his hand, and there was nothing going on in his head. And he never said anything, you know, his entire time that I knew him. And so I want to create characters who have interesting jobs, who have interesting thought patterns, who have interesting dilemmas in their lives. And so I start working with my characters, you know, as I'm developing my society, saying, who'd be the most interesting kind of character in this society? And then I work from there. Once I've got my characters, you know, there's different ways to develop characters. A lot of people will sit down and say, I'm going to write about this character. I'm going to figure out what color his eyes are, what color his hair is. There's a great book by a guy named Mark McCutcheon, Building Believable Characters. And you can look in that book, and it'll tell you, you know, 30 different ways to describe noses. And so you might go, oh, I've never thought about making a character with a pug nose. I think I'll make my hero with a pug nose today. And but once you get past that, you know, you're just really at the level of describing the character still. All that's good information to have. And it's good to be able to keep it on file so that you can refer to it later if you've got a character who hasn't been in, you know, for 200 pages and you've got to remember what he looks like or what he walks like or something like that. But the more important thing is, what kinds of conflicts do they have going? What, you know, is it they love most in the world? What are the things that they are most afraid of losing? You know, if you've got a protagonist, he's got to probably lose those things that he most clings to. And so building your powerful character just really requires you to really build powerful conflicts, okay? Mm-hmm. The really interesting conflicts. That's what's most important about creating your characters.
Okay, so when you're starting the process of imagining a really great character, do you take into account the character's dialogue or characteristics or something like that, or conflicts? What exactly is it that makes a character fascinating or makes you want to read more about a certain character?
There's a number of things that I look for when I'm writing about a character. First of all, I want to try to make my character likable in some way. And there's a number of things that you can do to make a character likable. You know, you can give that character really big problems, you know, conflicts that interesting, you know, that are really interesting, that, you know, instantly when someone reads your story, they just go, oh, wow, you know, I can't believe that. This guy has this giant parasite that's digging through his chest, you know, and it's going to kill him, you know, as it eats its way through. And he's only got 3 days to live, you know. Why, how would that be? You know, so maybe you're going to be thinking about that. Or maybe the conflict is an identity crisis where, let's say you've got a young man who happens to be walking home from school one day, and he comes upon a corpse, and he calls it into the police, and everybody thinks that he is a murderer, you know. Something like that. So I look for conflicts that immediately engage my audience. And I try to put those conflicts into the life of my character. The other thing that I do is try to make the person a likable person, you know. And so my major character is generally going to be somebody that you like for some reason or another. Now, there's a lot of reasons that you can like somebody. You might like somebody because they're really nice. We call it petting the dog, you know. Every time they see a dog, they go pat the dog, and how you doing there, dog? Or they love kids, and, you know, we're drawn to people who are nice, but not always, you know. There's a movie that my wife and I have watched every couple of years over and over. We kind of like, it's called Quigley Down Under, and the character of Quigley, you know, is introduced. And one of the first things he does is he has this guy that, you know, wants to get past some old people on this ship. And he's like, you know, get out of the way, I'm in a hurry, you know. And Quigley, you know, manages to hit him with the butt of his gun, you know, and kind of take him out of the picture. And we like that, you know. We're sort of like, ah, I wish I had the guts to go ahead and do that kind of thing, to just, you know, beat up somebody who's that rude. And you know, and so... Is Quigley really a nice person? You know, he resorts to violence pretty quickly, and he's really good at it when he does it. And so we admire him because he stands upon the strength of his convictions, even though he's probably not the kind of person that that most of us are. So sometimes giving a character a really good strength, making them really intelligent, making them good in a fight, making the person so that... you know, he's quick-witted. He says just the things that we wish that we would have said, you know, in any given situation. Those are just different ways. Yeah, just, those are just different ways of making them likable.
Let's see. And I guess just as as an example of that, could you talk about, let me think of a character off the top of my head. How did you start, say, the process of imagining Gaborin from the Rune Lords?
Well, Gaborin was an interesting character. I mean, I looked at him early on, and I knew that he was sort of young and maybe a little bit impulsive. You know, one of the first things that I did was, the name Gaborin is an old German name, which means earthborn. Which was an interesting choice because I didn't do it consciously. It wasn't until one of my first readers pointed it out, and I go, oh my gosh, I can't believe I did that, you know. But I consciously chose, for example, a German name because I wanted the book to appeal to Germans. And so, okay, I gave him sort of a Germanic name, Gaborin Valorden, and, you know, that has helped. I got very strong sales in Germany. And even today I was speaking with a German video game maker who wants to make a big, massive, multi-user online role-playing game. And he's looking at the Rune Lords very carefully. And, you know, I wonder if maybe that little subconscious use of name is one of the things that has really drawn him to it. But so I did that. The other thing I did was that I gave him a big conflict. You know, he is a he is morally opposed to the magic system that gives him power. So he's sort of a conscientious objector. And so he realizes that, you know, yeah, it gives me power, but I'm a nice guy, and I really can't use this system very easily. And then I put him in conflict with somebody who is ruthless and, you know, almost godlike in his power. And so I give him really big problems. And so, you know, it's one of those things where you just, you know, kind of go through and do everything that you can to make that character fascinating. Gaborn, for me, was sort of an everyman character. I just felt like I wanted him to be, I didn't want him to be super talented in anything, you know, like he's the world's greatest fighter or anything. He's just sort of like the average reader, you know, but he has a very strong moral compass, and that was maybe his strength.
And
that's how I develop him.
Cool. Now you had mentioned conflicts before, that you have to have your character have conflicts to make them interesting.
Mm-hmm.
How do you know that you've got a really good conflict?
Okay, there's a couple of different things. First of all, you can't have the same kind of conflict, you know, over and over again. So you have to have a number of them. And so we often divide them up into different types of conflicts. You have your external conflicts, you know, which means the conflict that the character has are sort of outside of himself. Like maybe one conflict is, I need to go 100 miles in a day on a horse, okay? And I know my horse is going to die after about 20 miles, and I'm going to have to get another horse. So the external conflict might be, he's trying to figure out how to get enough horses to get him to go that 100 miles in the time frame that he has. Okay, that's an example of an external conflict. An external conflict might be a conflict with nature. You know, you're trying to drive through a really bad storm. Okay, that's one type of conflict. If all you have are external conflicts, though, your story gets boring really fast. Okay, because it's like those old nature shows that I used to watch when I was a kid. I loved watching shows about people who got stuck out in the wilderness, you know.
Okay.
But very often it became a story of, okay, he fights off the wolves, he fights off the grizzly bear, he has to fight off a wild caribou, and he has to get through the raging storm, you know. It's all external conflicts. They become much more interesting if you have internal conflicts. You know, if you've got a crisis of faith, or you've got a problem with honesty, or you've got a person who's abusing your name, you know. So you start developing external and internal conflicts. And then the next thing you do is you start creating interpersonal conflicts. You know, you've got a woman that you love that doesn't love you back, and you're trying to win her. You know, that might be an external conflict. Or you have a villain who's trying to stop you from winning her because he wants her to. You know, you have those. And so first thing that I look for is a mix. But beyond that, beyond looking for that mix, I have to look at the ones that just touch me deeply, you know, as an author. And you can't impose the ones that touch you deeply on other people. Okay, let me see if I can explain that. When I have a conflict that touches me deeply, it only maybe touches me deeply. You know, if you've had an abusive father and you write a story about a father who's really abusive, you know, that might work really well for you. Meanwhile, the woman who's sitting next to you says, gosh, I loved my father. He's never done anything bad to me in his entire life. And he was always supportive, and he was there every time I needed him. He was my best friend. Well, you know, that person's not going to respond to your conflict. And that's one of the things that you have to realize, is that there's never any set of magic conflicts, magic characters, magic worlds that appeal to everybody. You know, that's why some stories work better than others. And that's one of the big problems with new writers, is that we pick conflicts that only work for us or work within a really narrow frame. So I look for a bunch of conflicts, and then I just play with them. And I kind of go, well, you know, wouldn't it be neat if, you know, as he's going to this thing, he meets, you know, this person. And those conflicts just kind of come to me, you know, through the process of writing. I might be, I just finished a novel and got the first draft done, and I'm now working on my second draft. And I'm still finding little conflicts, you know, and things that I get, oh, wouldn't it be neat if this guy had this happen? Wouldn't it be neat if wouldn't it be great if, you know, this person told him off right here, or, you know. And so things like that just kind of happen over the course of the story. You start building them in. And in any case with a character, you might have 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 conflicts going, you know, in the course of a chapter. If you do that, the thing tends to become more and more intriguing to the readers, because, you know, maybe your reader doesn't care about external conflict at all. It's sort of like, oh, well, you know, he's going through a big rainstorm, big deal. You know, meanwhile, another person is like, oh my gosh, I get so scared in rainstorms, you know, ever since that wreck that I had, you know, 4 years ago, I'm terrified of trying to drive in pounding rain. And so that conflict might work really well for one reader, but, you know, the other one just doesn't get that at all. So it's not until you say, you know, and, you know, he's rushing through the pounding rain to take this money to the man that he owes, to a debt collector, you know, so he can restore his good name, you know. And they go, yes, you know, my good name is all important to me. And so that reader might really respond to that conflict. And so you put a bunch of conflicts in there and put them together in such a way that you hope will really engage the readers and just totally keep them engrossed so they can't think about anything else. They forget that they're reading. They're stuck in your story.
Which is what you're after. And when you have your 6 conflict limit, when you get your 6, is that when you know that you have enough conflicts, or do you just keep adding them? Or
I think that it's, you know, and I don't know if there's a certain limit, you know. I mean, there are times when I'm writing a chapter where there's maybe only 2 conflicts that come into play, you know, and I just write really, really, how should I say this? Hang on here 1 sec.
Oh, no problem.
Spencer! Sorry about that. My son decided to practice his tuba just while I was talking.
That's all right.
Anyway, my wife and other son knew what was going on up here. Anyway, that was the question, the last question.
We were talking about...
Oh, the number of conflicts. The really important thing with these conflicts is that Orson Scott Card once described it as a juggling act. You know, you throw a conflict up in front of your reader, and as long as the reader is focusing on that conflict or thinking about that, they're going to be engaged. It's like juggling balls. When a juggler is juggling balls, he's throwing balls up in the air, but he's also throwing them from one hand to another. But you tend to watch only the one that's up in the air, and you're not conscious of the other ones that are in his hand. So what we try to do is to try to make sure that there is always a conflict going on in front of the reader. As soon as the conflicts are all out of the story, as soon as we drop the balls, as soon as there's nothing going on, the reader's eyes glaze over and they start saying, wow, this book is getting boring.
Yeah.
And so we try to keep meaningful conflicts up, you know, going all the time, maybe 2 or 3. The big thing is not just have one conflict or to have no conflicts at all. You know, so we want to make sure that there's always something there for the audience to hook onto.
Okay. definitely want to make sure we keep people interested. And you said, I've heard you say that the goal of writing when we write is so that we can evoke an emotional response to the reader. Are there certain ways that you go about evoking emotional responses, or say pulling at somebody's heartstrings?
I think that the way to do it is really to write sort of honestly about the things that would generate that emotion. For example, let's say that I want to have, I'm going to write a romance novel. Have you ever watched a romance story where you look at the major character, you look at the guy on the screen, and you go, you know, he's kind of a creep. I don't really like him. You know, he's a jock. He's dismissive of other people. You know, he pushes them around. And, you know, he's quite frankly not good enough for this girl, okay? That happens to me from time to time, where I'll look at a romance and I'll just say, that doesn't quite pull my heartstrings. What that means is that you as an author have what we call a formulation error. You have created a character who we as an audience just aren't tracking with, you know. And so your job then is to go back and figure out, okay, how can I make it so that you as a reader fall in love with that character? Because it's not until the reader falls in love with both characters, both the male and the male protagonist and your female protagonist, that they're going to want them to, you know, have a romantic ending. And so we have to go through and try to figure out, okay, how do I make my reader, or how do I let my reader fall in love with both these characters before they fall in love with each other, so that the reader is rooting for them to get together. And all of that is done really not by saying, oh, she was so beautiful, he lusted after her and his heart pounded, and, you know, nobody had ever been as in love as he was in love at this time. You can talk about love, but that doesn't arouse the feeling of love in the reader. You have to create the moments and the real emotions by creating the incidents that incite those emotions, okay? And that's just how you do it. There's no real trick beyond that.
Okay, so creating moments. And just because I thought this question was interesting, have you ever written, say, a scene between two characters, like I'm thinking of Rune Lord's characters, Gaborn and Iome, that made you cry, where you went, wow, that was good, and you had to grab the Kleenex?
Oh, gosh, you know, I don't want to admit that I'm one of those writers, but I think every writer does that to some degree. You know, we go through and, you know, if the story, well, you know, okay, this novel that I was writing, I got in and wrote the first chapter, and I was in tears at the end of this first chapter. I was feeling so bad for my character. And I'm just going, you know, hey, I've been doing this for 25 years. I'm not supposed to break into tears, you know. But if it's not affecting you emotionally, it probably won't affect your readers emotionally. And that's just my feeling. And so, yeah, I went through and was reading In the Company of Angels. And I watched my wife when she was reading it, and I noticed that she started crying 100 pages before the end, and I kept her in tears for 100 pages. And I was thinking, that was really good. And then I went through and was editing the darn thing and found out that I was in tears for the last 100 pages, and you know, which is why it's so poorly edited, because I had my editors writing to me and said, I had to stop for 2.5 hours because I was crying so bad I couldn't see the page, and, you know.
I didn't want to cut this, but too good.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, you want really badly to affect people, but unfortunately you do that with your editors. And so very often, if I notice that I'm not getting any editing marks in my manuscript for, you know, 30 or 40 pages, I go, uh-oh, I've got an editor who's so totally engaged that he's now no longer doing his job. And so then I have to go back and reread the thing and make sure that I do my job as a writer to try to make sure I capture all the errors myself. I had an editor a couple of years ago who said, I really, really love this book. I want to edit everything that this guy writes. And I noticed with my next book that it was practically unedited. You know, he's a big fan, and he just gets lost in the story. And so I've kind of had to go to the point where I say, I don't want that guy anymore. You know, not because he's not good at his job, but because he's just too involved in my writing, and he's not a good editor for me.
Yeah. So that we can get to the point where, I don't know, we have so many people reaching for the Kleenex, and we're even going out to buy more boxes at the store. Are there fundamentals of storytelling that we need to master to get to that point?
Yeah. I mean, you know, there are so many. How should I say that? It's like a chain, and there's so many links in the chain that you can't ignore one. You know, and those fundamentals come in all sorts of things. You know, it's how well are you imagining your characters? How well are you imagining your scenes? How realistic does it seem? Are you surprising the reader with insights and, flourishes of imagination that sort of go, wow, what did they think about that, you know? Those type of things. But then there's just the basic writing itself, you know? I talk about describing a scene, and you can describe a scene and describe it beautifully. You can describe it powerfully. You can take it to another level where you start adding in metaphors and describing it poetically so that you just absolutely transport the reader into that scene perfectly. And once you've done that, as long as the scene itself generates emotion, as long as you've got something going on that's worth having dragged that reader, you know, into that scene, then, great things are going to start happening in the story. I recently read, I had someone invite me to read a novel, and he said, oh, this novel is absolutely great. And I started reading it, and the writing was brilliant. The descriptive powers of this young author were just phenomenal. But there was nothing happening in that novel. You know, 30 pages into it, she is standing on a porch, you know, looking at these gorgeous spider webs and, you know, describing the bleak landscape in West Texas just beautifully and, you know, la-da-da-da. And I was going like, okay, so what's happening? And really, it was a novel that got published because of the poetic powers of the author, but the author hadn't really learned to be much of a storyteller yet, and so it came off really pretty flat.
Well, I've just been notified we've got about 8 minutes left.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know if you wanted to call a halt to things, or if you wanted to keep going for
let's go ahead and do some question and answers. And,
okay, I guess five now.
I'd love to be able to see what anybody else has. Yeah.
Okay. Give me just a moment here. Let's see. Technical difficulties here. Sorry.
Okay.
All right. If the people in the audience who have a question for Dave could press five star right now, you'll be able to come on and he'll be able to start answering some questions for you. Okay. Looks like we've got Mark has a question. Let me see. Mark, are you there?
Sorry, folks. It's our first time trying this.
Yeah. Inaugural voyage here. Hold on just a moment.
Hello? Hi. Hello, is this Mark?
Yes, it is.
Great.
All right.
All right. David, I had a question about pacing.
Sure.
If you're dealing with a novel length work, let's say it's a 300-page novel, about how far into the novel do you need to have the main plot kicking in? Do you have some luxury of space with a 300 or a 350-page novel, or do you need to start amping up the conflict and the excitement early? You mentioned this this wonderful author who writes beautifully, but nothing was happening 30 pages in.
Yeah. Generally speaking, and this is a rule that holds pretty good in short stories, novels, movies, typically about 10% of the way in is where we get to the end of an inciting incident. So if you've got a 300-page novel, then within 30 pages, we ought to have an idea of what this entire book is about. You know, this is going to be the major conflict that's going to be covered in this book. So we need to get the characters introduced. We need to get we've probably got to have some minor conflicts that are going to carry us up to that, you know, inciting incident. And very often an inciting incident, you know, just sort of takes the reader by surprise. It's like, whoa, I had no idea this was coming, you know. And suddenly we find ourselves into a story. So, for example, one of the old fairy tales, you know, we see over and over again is you've got a young person who's having his conflicts in town, getting bullied by the neighbor kids, and, you know, 30 pages in, you know, suddenly somebody comes in and says, ah, you're the prince. You know, come, you know, and your father has just died, and, you know, you were sent off into hiding when you were a youth, and all of a sudden he has to deal with all these conflicts, and all those little things that he felt as a kid, you know, are sort of meaningless. And so, you know, very often it's sort of like amping things up just, you know, 1,000% to go from that inciting incident to that new part. But 10% is a pretty good figure. And I've actually got a theory that someday maybe I'm going to write about this that has to do with mathematics and why that 10% is sort of important. But I have a theory that pacing in a novel or in a story form follows a sort of a natural pacing that that can be seen in nature in the formation of various seashells and things like that. There was some work that was done back in the Middle Ages on mathematics and how it, you know, various formulas work with making things just seem perfect in art. And I think it can be done actually in writing too. But it's kind of interesting.
Okay, let's see. I've been told we've got a 2-minute warning.
Okay.
It would hold on just 1 second here. Would you mind going over, or do you want me to just?
No, we can go. We can go ahead and go over. I figured I'd probably give him another 15 minutes or so.
Oh, all right. Well, thank you very much. Okay, so next we have Christy with a question. Christy, are you there?
Hi there.
Hi, Christy.
Hi, Dave. How are you doing?
I'm doing great.
Great. My question for you has to do with something I've heard you talk about in the past, and that is when you're writing and you're first getting out there, should you settle for smaller publishing companies? Should you try and get your books out there with smaller publishing companies, or should you just keep writing until you are able to capture the attention of a larger publishing company?
I think this is a really tough advice for people to follow, but I think that you should go for the larger publishing company. Anytime that you go into the creative arts, you want to try to make as big a splash as possible when you come in. My first novel, On My Way to Paradise, you know, when it came out, it stayed on the bestseller list for about 5 months in science fiction. And so it had a really good run, and the fact is that I've been able to make a living on writing pretty much ever since. And I wouldn't have been able to do that, and I wouldn't have been able to devote myself to, you know, perfecting my craft, putting out more and more stories, building my audience, and that kind of thing. So if I had written a novel that, you know, only got bought by 3,000 or 5,000 people or something, I just really wouldn't have, you know, blown things open. The other thing that happens is that if you write to a small audience, and you're not writing to a big one, you know, you can kind of get pegged in the industry pretty quickly. I knew an author years ago who had published maybe 55 or 60 stories in non-professional magazines, and could not sell a story to Asimov's or any of the big magazines to save her life. And she won Writers of the Future. But I always felt like she had sort of shot herself in the foot by publishing the non-professional magazine, because I really felt like she was a lot better than that, you know. This is somebody who should have been publishing in the big magazines. So when you start out, you know, you don't really want to get pegged as being a small writer. You know, it may be that if you do, that publishers won't ever take a risk on you and try to promote your work heavily. Instead, they'll be really reticent. So you want to start developing a name right out the gate. And if that means that you have to write 2 or 3 practice books before you ever really launch your career, you're better off in the long run doing that, you know, because if you go out and let's say you write a practice book and you go get it published and maybe you make, you know, $3,000 on that book, you know, the next 10 books that you write, you're going to make $3,000 a book on them, because you're going to get pegged by the retailers as somebody that only sells 3,000 books. Meanwhile, if you go out and write a book that, you know, is going to make you $3 million, you know, and it happens to be your 4th or 5th book, you really made a lot more money in the long run by going for that big breakout novel. And so I personally, you know, that's sort of my philosophy. I say, you know, go ahead and try to make as much of a splash as you can right out the gate.
Great advice. Thanks.
Okay.
All right. And I have another question, but I don't have a name. The number ending in 1848. Could you give your name and then ask your question?
Hi. My name's Tony.
Hi, Tony.
Hi. My question is that I've had a vampire story that I'd like to work on, but with current glut of vampire stories on the market right now, is now really a good time to even try to do a vampire story?
Oh, my. You know, that's really a personal question. You know, a personal question for you, because, you know, a lot of it has to do with how much do you love it, how motivated are you to write it, how much do you believe in it. I personally, as an editor, I recently read a romance novel from a woman that had the vampire romance, and I was just totally absorbed in that book, despite the fact that I was sort of getting to the point where I say, I wish I never would see another vampire book again, you know? So it's hard to know how long this wave will ride. But the other thing is, or how long you'll be able to ride this wave, but the other thing about it is that there are people that I call genre makers. And those are people who write so well about a topic that, you know, it sort of like creates a whole new bubble, you know, and the thing grows. The entire genre grows because of it. And you never know when those are going to pop out. You know, you could look at and I'm going to call the whole vampire thing a subgenre. You can look at the whole, you know, vampire subgenre and say, well, that's absolutely dead. But it's been dead for a long time. I thought it was dead, you know, in the 1980s. But, you know, you start looking at things like Interview with a Vampire, you know, came out, and, you know, all of a sudden there were a lot of people reading vampire things. And then Buffy the Vampire Slayer came out on TV, and that went really big. And then when Buffy the Vampire Slayer was taken off in May of the year that it was canceled from the air, and in June, all of a sudden we have Stephanie Meyer writing Twilight, and now the vampire genre is bigger than ever. It was bigger than, you know, than any of the previous incarnations. And so for me to say that, oh, gosh, it's all over, is premature. You know, it ain't over till it's over, and even when it's over, it ain't over in this game, you know. Pirate books. Robinson Crusoe was, you know, a huge hit 200 years ago. Swiss Family Robinson, 120 years ago, became a huge hit. It looks like with the pirate stories that were being told in the 1920s, there were a number of different publications that were just doing pirate stories, and they were doing really well. In fact, it was its whole little subgenre in pulp fiction of pirate magazines. And they all went away. And then Pirates of the Caribbean was made primarily because Disney wanted more people to come visit its rides at Disneyland. And suddenly pirates are popular again, you know. And so these genres tend to sort of go away and lose popularity and then come back. And it really, all it takes is a writer with a great imagination who can figure out how to connect with the wide audience to bring that back. So, you know, go ahead and write your book if you really want to. And as long as you really feel motivated, go ahead and do it and figure out how to connect to a wide audience. And it doesn't matter if the genre is dead, dying, or just begun. You know, you're still going to be a hit.
Great. Thanks.
All right. I have one more call or one more question. Don't have a name, but the number is 5431. And I'm gonna say that this one's gonna be the last one for tonight. And I want to say thanks again for going a little over with us. We really appreciate that.
Happy to.
Yes, I'm 5431.
Okay.
My name.
Go ahead.
Oh, yes. I'm having trouble understanding exactly what beats are. Could you please explain to me beats?
Sure.
And how they connect to audience.
Okay, sure. A beat, when we talk about an emotional beat in a story, we can talk about anything that arouses an emotion, okay? Maybe, and I think a lot of the confusion here might have to do with, if you've studied screenwriting, it talks about beats in a slightly different way. A beat is almost a measure of seconds. So, for example, let's say that somebody says something funny, and then the writer will say, "Waits a beat," you know. Give them a couple seconds for the audience to laugh. This is a little bit different. When we talk about beats, as far as emotional beats, we're talking about anything that arouses an emotion. So if you look at a commercial, and when you go to the movies next time, watch a 3-minute commercial.
Mm-hmm.
And let's say that it starts out and the first thing that you hear is, you know, you've got two people and somebody makes a good cut, okay? So it's a good comic joke. That's a comic beat in parlance for this kind of thing. So we say, okay, there's a comic beat. And then suddenly it shows this magnificent landscape with a skyship sailing off, you know, over the clouds. And so you now have a wonder beat, okay? And so it's any scene or any action, any dialogue that creates an emotion in the reader. So that what happens is, as you're a viewer or if you're a reader and you see that little brief commercial, it creates that emotion or the anticipation of that emotion, and you start going, oh, yeah, that looks cool. I love that scene with that thing flying over. I'd love to see where that spaceship is going. That character sounds really funny. I want to hear the rest of what he has to say. And so when we talk about emotional beats, we're talking about every single scene, every single incident in the entire storyline, and what its main emotional beat is. What is it trying to do to the reader? What's it promising its viewer, for example, if you're making a commercial, so that they want to come to see your movie? Because some of them will be adventure, you know, it sort of gets your heart stirring, and, you know, so let's say you've got a fight scene. Other ones will be humorous. Other ones might be terrifying. You know, you might see a monster jumping out of a closet. You know, all of those little things, those are emotional beats. And the more that you can pack into a commercial and the more targeted you are to a specific audience, then the more appeal that commercial will have, the more people it will draw into the theater. And so there's an entire art and science to creating commercials for movies so that you can maximize your appeal to the audience. And, you know, you may try to get as many in 3 minutes, you might try to get as many as 200 or 300 different emotional beats and get a certain mix so that you go, okay, the young men are going to want to see the movie because of these emotional beats. The young women are going to see it because of these. So now we've got this great date movie, and we'll try to bring in the older audience by throwing in a scene where, you know, the moms and dads are talking, and so we do all of that to sort of promise to the audience that this is what this movie is going to deliver. Okay.
Right. You have to balance those beats so it doesn't come across too comic bookish. Too much of the external.
Yeah. Exactly.
Internal.
Yeah, we want to get at, you know, for example, every good commercial is going to get at sort of the heart of what the story's about. You know, what are the major conflicts that they're going to be resolved? Is it a love story? Is it an adventure? Is it is it going to be a horror story? Is this going to be just something that's going to deal with politics? Is it Wall Street? You know, what is this story about? And once those conflicts and everything are up in the air, and once we see what's going on, that basically builds anticipation to the point where you say, okay, I'm going to break down and spend my $8 to go to that movie next week.
Okay. Build up the anticipation.
That's exactly right. Anticipation, suspense.
Great. All right. Thank you so much.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you, everybody,
thank
for
you.
Coming.
Oh, sorry. I hate to bust in, but probably about time to wrap it up. If this forum isn't enough for people, is there anything coming up that any workshops or anything coming up you'd like to let us know about?
Well, sure. I think I have two workshops that I have prepared, and the two workshops that I have, I've got one in June that's going to be a professional writer's workshop. And that's going to be a one-week workshop where you'll be working on your novels, basically. And we'll go through and do exercises to help them. But we'll also be, you know, critiquing the openings to your books and trying to help you figure out how to sell them and this type of thing. I'm also doing a professional writer's workshop, and that one's going to be held, by the way, in Salt Lake City. And I'm also doing a professional writer's Superstars of Writing seminars with Kevin J. Anderson and Brandon Sanderson and Eric Flint and Rebecca Moesta, and we got Carolyn Kenyon. Carolyn, I think that's how it's pronounced. Sherilyn Kenyon, is also going to be a guest with us. And they're all New York Times bestselling authors, and we're going to be talking about the business of writing. How do you, not just how do you get published, okay, because a lot of people, when they're new, they just think, oh, God, I want to get published. What we really want to talk about is how you get published really well. How do you break the New York Times bestseller list? And so all of the authors there are going to be New York Times bestsellers. And that's going to be January 13th through the 15th. And then I'm also going to announce, I promised some young ladies yesterday that I would do a little two-day seminar somewhere in Utah, this is going to be probably up in the Salt Lake area, and I'm going to do that in April. So I'm going to have a Write That Novel seminar that I'll be having coming up. Okay?
Wow, sounds very busy, but, thanks very much, Dave, for giving your time for us tonight and for letting us go a little over. And I want to thank everybody for attending this inaugural session of Farland's Authors Advisory, and I hope you found it enlightening and informative, and we'll talk again in about a month.
Okay, great. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Dave. Bye.
Okay, bye-bye.